As we continue with contract law, we are going to be looking at vitiating factors. So we have established the elements of contract formation. We've said for there to be a binding contract, we must have valid offer, valid acceptance, good consideration, intention to create a binding relationship, and the capacity to contract. And having established that there is a valid contract, we now look at what are the contents of the contract. And know that we distinguish between a statement that is mere representation as opposed to a statement that is a term of the contract. And the Oscar Chess case establishes four tests that must be applied to determine whether a statement is a mere representation or it is a term of the contract. And then we have established that there are two broad terms. There are express terms and there are implied terms. Where express terms are concerned, there are two categories or three categories, namely the condition, warranty, intermediate term. And then where implied terms are concerned, terms can be implied by custom, they can be implied through the courts, and if they're implied through the courts, then they're implied by the facts or they're implied in law. And then, of course, terms can be implied by statute. So I mean, to establish what the content of the contract is, then we now go on to look at vitiating factors. So we have a valid contract, and the question is, what can negate that contract or what can negative that contract? And these are called vitiating factors. And vitiating factors include mistake, misrepresentation, duress, undue influence, and illegality. And we're going to look at the effect that these factors have on a contract. So let's begin. So where the elements required to form a contract are all present, the parties are entitled to assume that the expectations reasonably raised by their conduct will be sanctioned by the court. So there are circumstances in which this assumption may be defeated by the presence of other factors such as by mistake, which at common law may make the contract void, or by misrepresentation, which may make the contract voidable. It is generally in the interest of business that contracts be enforced. Thus, most mistakes, for example, as to the quality of a product will not affect the validity of a contract. So what we need to now recognize that there are common law rules on mistake, and if applicable, the effect is to render the contract void, but these rules are exercised within narrow limits. And then there are equitable rules of mistake, which have a wider scope, but they have a less dramatic effect. It is important to distinguish a contract which is void for mistake from one which is voidable for misrepresentation. The distinction is of little importance to the parties themselves, since the goods or monies can be recovered from the other party to the contract if they are still in his or her possession. The distinction is of significance if the goods have been sold to a third party. For example, if A sells his car to B and B resells it to C, if the contract between A and B is void for mistake, A can recover the car from C because no title passes under a void contract. C will be able to sue B for breach of the implied condition that he had a right to sell and pass the title. However, in a similar situation, if the contract between A and B is only voidable for misrepresentation, then provided the sale to C took place before A avoided the contract, C will obtain a good title since voidable means valid until avoided. A would then have to seek remedy for misrepresentation against B. So let's pause here to just establish that for mistake at common law, contract is void, meaning it did not exist. It's void ab initio, void from the outset. And misrepresentation, it is voidable, which means that the contract is valid until it is avoided. And in those circumstances, it has implication in relation to whom the person may sue to recover the items or for breach of contract. So we're going to look at the common law rules now of mistake. So the following types of mistake render a contract void, provided the mistake actually induces the contract. So what are the types of mistake? One, mistake as to the existence of the subject matter. Two, mistake as to the possibility of performing contract. Three, mistake as to the identity of the subject matter. Four, mistake as to the identity of the other party. And five, mistake as to the terms of the contract of which the other party is aware. So we take them in turn. One, mistake as to the existence of the subject matter. And here we're going to be relying on the case law to illustrate the point. So the first case that we're going to look at is Galloway and Galloway. A man and a woman made a separation agreement believing that they were married. In fact, they were not married because unknown to them at the time of their marriage ceremony, the man's wife still alive. Separation agreement was held to be void for mistake because the marriage, which was the basis of the agreement, was void. Second type of mistake is mistake as to the possibility of performing the contract. And here again, we look to the common law. And the case here is Sheik Brothers and Oxner. A contract was made for the exploitation of sisal grown on a specific plot of land. The contract provided for an average daily delivery of 50 tons of sisal per month. The contract was held to be void because the land was not capable of producing 50 tons per month. The third type of mistake that we're going to look at is mistake as to the identity of the subject matter. And an example is A intends to buy product X, but B intends to buy product Y. And when we go back to first principles, this is an example of cross offer, cross purposes. So the minds are not meeting. And remember that we said if there's an offer, the acceptance must reflect, mirror that offer. Therefore, if there is any difference in terms of the acceptance or the terms of acceptance and the offer, that might be a counter offer. And if there's a mismatch, then it is a cross offer. So no contract will be found. So if there is a mistake as to the identity of the subject matter, then it is likely that that contract is going to be void for mistake. And here the case is Raffles and Wichelhaus. So the plaintiff agreed to sell to the defendant a consignment of cotton which was to arrive ex-Peerless Bombay, and that was the name of a ship. There happened to be two ships called Peerless sailing from Bombay, one in October and the other in December. The plaintiff was thinking of the one ship and the defendant of another, and it was held that there was no contract because the parties, the minds, had not met in relation to the same ship. So there was a mistake. So mistake as to the identity of the subject matter. It is important to be able to distinguish a mistake as to the identity of, as to identity, as opposed to a mistake as to quality. Now remember, so we have a general rule, and what we're saying is, generally speaking, mistake is renders a contract void, whereas mistake as to quality does not render a contract void. So all the five types of mistake would have the effect of rendering the contract void, except for mistake as to quality, which does not render the contract void. And persons may sometime not be able to distinguish between mistake as to identity and mistake as to quality, but one has to pay close attention. So in Smith and Hughes, and this gives us an example now of mistake as to quality as opposed to mistake to identity. So the plaintiff was shown a sample of oats by the defendant, and thinking that they were old oats, he bought them. They were in fact new oats, and he refused to accept them. It was held that his mistake did not invalidate the contract because this was a mistake as to quality. Parties were at cross purposes, but not to such an extent that there was no agreement at all. The mistake was only one of quality, and as such does not operate to render the contract void. A mistake as to quality will only invalidate the contract if it is a mistake as the fundamental quality by which the thing is identified, but not if it is a mistake as to one of the various other qualities of the product. And I trust that is clear. So if the quality is intertwined with the identity, so like for instance, Blue Mountain Coffee, as opposed to Colombian coffee, then that is a question of quality and identity that is intertwined. But if it is a version of Blue Mountain Coffee, then it would not be a mistake as to identity necessarily. Now, the fourth type of mistake is mistake as to the identity of the other party. The mistake as to the identity cannot be made when the parties deal face to face. In such a situation, a person can only make a mistake as to the attributes, i.e. the quality of the other party and not his identity. An agreement made between X and Y will be void if X can prove that at the time of the agreement, he regarded the identity of the other party as of importance. He did not intend to contract with Y, but with a different person, Z. And the fact was known to Y. So if Y knows that Z is not intent on contracting with them, then that is a mistake as the identity and the contract would be void. So to illustrate the point is Condi and Lindsay case. So here a fraudulent person named Blencarn, writing from 37 Wood Street, Cheapside, offered to buy handkerchiefs for the plaintiff who manufactured handkerchiefs. And he signed his letter in such a way that his name appeared to be Blencarn and Company. Blencarn and Co. The latter was a respectable firm carrying on business at 123 Wood Street, Blencarn, occupied a room which he called 37 Wood Street, but in fact, its entrance was from an adjoining street. Plaintiffs who were aware of the high reputation of Blencarn and Co., though they neither knew nor troubled to ascertain the number of the street where they did business, purported to accept the offer and dispatch the goods to Messrs. Blencarn and Co., 37 Wood Street, Cheapside. These were received by the rogue Blencarn, and he in turn sold them to the defendants, who took them in all good faith. Plaintiff sued the defendants for conversion. It was held that there was no contract between the plaintiffs and Blencarn, since the plaintiffs intended to deal with someone else. Thus the title to the handkerchiefs did not pass to Blencarn, and so he could not pass title to the defendants. The defendants therefore had to return the handkerchiefs to the plaintiffs. And this case can be contrasted with Lewis and Avery, where a rogue posing as Richard Green, well-known film actor, called upon the plaintiff and offered to buy his car, which was advertised for sale at £450. The plaintiff accepted the offer and was given a check signed R.A. Green for £450. Afraid that the check might be worthless, he resisted the proposal that the car should be removed at once. The rogue, by way of showing that he was Richard Green, produced a special pass of admission to Pinewood Studios bearing an official stamp. Satisfied with this, the plaintiff handed over the logbook and allowed the car to be taken away. The check had been stolen and was worthless. The rogue, now passing as Lewis, sold the car to the defendant and handed over the logbook to him. The action of conversion by the plaintiff for the recovery of the car or its value failed. The Court of Appeal held that despite his mistake, the plaintiff had concluded a contract with the rogue. He had failed to rebut the prima facie presumption that he had made a contract with a rogue when he allowed the car to be taken away. The contract was no doubt voidable for fraud, but it could not be avoided now that the car had come into the hands of an innocent purchaser for value. Voidable means valid until avoided, and the plaintiff had not avoided by the time the rogue sold the car to the defendant. The contract was therefore valid, and the rogue was able to pass title to the defendant. And I pause here to say that there is a thin line here between mistake as to the identity of the other party and that of fraudulent misrepresentation. And in these particular instances, what is happening is that the court is actually making a decision on the basis of fraudulent misrepresentation as opposed to mistake as to the identity of the other party. So in King Norton Metal and Eldridge Merritt, the plaintiff received an order for wire from Hallam & Co. The letterhead depicted a large factory and described Hallam & Co. as a substantial firm. In fact, Hallam & Co. did not exist, being merely an alias for a crook called Wallace. Plaintiff sent the goods to Hallam & Co. on credit. Wallace took possession of them and resold them to the defendant. It was held that as Wallace and Hallam and Co. were the same person, the plaintiff had not made a mistake as to identity, but had intended to contract with the writer of the letters. Thus, the contract was only voidable for fraud, and since Wallace sold to the defendants before the plaintiff avoided the contract, the defendant obtained good title to the goods. So that takes us now to the fifth type of mistake at common law, which is a mistake as to the terms of the contract of which the other party is aware. And here the case illustrating this point is Hartog and Collins and Shields. The seller of hair skin mistakenly offered them at a price per pound instead of per piece, there being about 3 pieces to the pound. The buyer, knowing of the mistake, accepted the offer and later sued the seller for non-delivery. His actions failed since he knew that the seller did not intend to contract on the terms stated. So that now brings us to how do we categorize mistake. And there are different terminologies that are used to describe the various types of mistake. So we have unilateral mistake. This occurs when one of the parties is mistaken about some fundamental fact and the other party knows or should know this. And an example is in the case of Cundy and Lindsay. And then there's bilateral or common mistake. And this occurs when both parties make the same mistake. Usually, this will be a mistake as to the existence of the subject matter. Example, Galloway and Galloway. And then the third category is mutual mistake. This occurs when two parties mean different things. It will normally be a mistake as to identity of the subject matter of the contract. And an example there is Raffles and Wichell House. So we have looked at mistake as a vitiating factor in the context of common law. We said that there are 5 types of mistake. We have identified them, we have explained them, and we have used cases to illustrate them. So we go now to the rules relating to mistake having regard to equity. So the rules of equity where mistake is concerned. So equity will, in limited situations, relieve a party from the effects of his mistake where the common law would hold him to the contract. So in fulfillment of the principles of equity, the court interferes in two respects. First, it will, if it thinks fit, set aside the contract on such terms as are just, whether it is void at common law or not. And the equitable remedy is that of rescission. Secondly, it rectifies a written contract or deed that does not accurately record the agreement made by parties. And the equitable remedy here is rectification. So we have two equitable remedies in relation to mistake when the rules of equity are applied. One, rescission. Two, rectification. So let's look a little bit closer at these equitable remedies. So rescission, the circumstances when this remedy will be granted have never been precisely defined. In general, it will only be granted if the party seeking to rescind was not at fault, so that's the innocent part, and provided justice can be done to the other party by imposing conditions. So the case that establishes or illustrates this point is Grist and Bailey. Plaintiff agreed to buy the defendant's house subject to an existing tenancy. The value of the house with vacant possession was about £2,250, but the purchase price was fixed at £850 since both parties believed that the tenancy was protected by the Rents Act. This belief was wrong. In fact, the tenant left without claiming protection. In an action for a specific performance, and this again is another equitable remedy, brought by the plaintiff, the defendant counterclaimed that the contract be set aside on the ground of common mistake. So whereas the person who is bringing the suit is relying on equitable remedies, the person who is defending the suit is relying on common law. Remember that at common law, the mistake would render the contract void, and therefore it would have no effect from the outset. Whereas in equity, contract is not going to be invalidated, but the parties will be allowed to go back to the drawing board and renegotiate the terms of the contract if it is fair for them. So in Grist and Bailey, it was held that though the mistake did not suffice to nullify the contract at law, it was material enough to attract the intervention of equity. And that is really the statement of equity. So equity is not going to render the contract invalid. Equity is going to seek to find a remedy that is fair in the circumstances. So the contract for a sale of £850 was rescinded in equity with the condition imposed that the vendor should give the purchaser first option to buy the house at the correct market price. So we turn now to look at the other equitable remedy of rescission. And remember, we're now looking at the context of mistake in the context of equitable remedies or equity, equitable rules. So where there has been a mistake, not in the actual agreement, but in the reduction, in its reduction to writing, equity will rectify the written document so that it coincides with the true agreement of the parties. Suppose that A orally agrees to sell a house exclusive of its adjoining yard to B. Owing to a mistake, the latter formally and through written instrument includes the yard as part of the property to be sold. And what is worse, subsequent conveyance actually conveys the yard to B. In a case of this type, where it is proved that owing to a mistake, the written contract does not substantially represent the real intention of the parties, the court has jurisdiction not only to rectify the written agreement, but also to order specific performance of its rectification, right? Or specific performance of it as rectified. So what are we talking about here? So now we're talking about two remedies. Talking about rectification, and we're talking about specific performance, and these are equitable remedies. So a mistake is made, land is sold that was not intended to be sold, and this is put in writing. It's brought to the court's attention, the court accepts that there's a mistake made, the court says, well, based on equity, you have to rewrite this contract to reflect what the parties had actually agreed. And since you would have transferred the land to the buyer by mistake, the buyer now has to transfer that land back to the original owner because they know fully well that the original owner had no intention of selling that part of land. So it is, however, not the contract itself which is rectified, but the incorrect manner in which the common intention of the parties have been expressed in a later document. So you're not changing the original contract. What you're doing is correcting the wrong or the false documentation. So rectification will be allowed provided, one, the terms were clearly agreed between the parties. Two, the agreement continued unchanged up to the time it was written. Three, the writing fails to express the agreement of the parties. So here's a case that illustrates the point. So Weeds and Blaney, plaintiff orally agreed with the defendant to sell him a farmhouse and some land. Plaintiff solicitor, in error, prepared a contract which included further land owned by the plaintiff. The error was not noticed and the land was transferred to the defendant, who became the registered owner. It was held that the plaintiff was entitled to rectification of the contract and the transfer. So again, the court is correcting the error that was made. That brings us now to the Latin remedy of nonis factum. So we have dealt with mistake as a vitiating factor. We have looked at the five types of mistake at common law. We have looked at the three categories in which mistake can be placed. And we have looked at the equitable rules of mistake and the equitable remedies that are applicable when we're talking about mistake in equity, which is rescission, rectification, specific performance. So this remedy that we are speaking about has to do with whether documents are mistakenly signed. So this mistake is different from the mistake that we are speaking about when it comes on to common law mistake and equitable rules of mistake. This mistake is if the party has not genuinely addressed their minds to the contract that they are entering into. But we must remember we start from a general rule. And what is the general rule? General rule is that signed documents, the general rule concerning signed documents is that a person is bound even if he or she does not read or understand the document. So let us be clear. So as a starting point, what we are saying is that once you sign a document, if you don't read it, if you don't understand it, you are bound by it. So you cannot say it's a mistake if you didn't read it, nor can you say it is a mistake if you did not understand it. So let's be clear. And this is not the first time that we would have come upon this general rule. We met this general rule when we're looking at exclusion clauses under the content of contract. And what we were discussing there is how do exemption clauses or exclusion clauses are incorporated into a contract. And one of them is if you sign a document without reading, then you are binding yourself to the term of that contract, right? And Lestrange and Gorkum is the case that illustrates that point. Now, here is the exception to that general rule. And the exception to that general rule is captured by the Latin phrase, nonis factum. It is not my act. So, however, an apparent signed contract will be regarded as void if a party can successfully plead the defense non est factum. And to successfully plead the defense of non est factum, three conditions must be satisfied. One, signature must have been induced by fraud. So here we go again, talking about fraud. So this is not a case where you were careless and you didn't read the document or you didn't understand what you signed anyway. Two, document must be fundamentally different from that thought to be signed. That is a subset of the fraudulent activities. So somebody say you're signing a car loan and it turns out that is a house loan you're signing, right? Two different. And then a mistake as the contents is not sufficient to allow non est factum to be raised. So again, it is not the content of the contract itself, but that what you are signing to is not what you had agreed any at all. So the party who is seeking to avoid the liability must prove that they acted with reasonable care. So the defendant, and here's a case that illustrates the point, this defense of non est factum, Lewis and Clay. So the defendant was induced to sign two promissory notes by the fraudulent misrepresentation that his signature was required as a witness. The rest of the document, apart from the space for the signature, was covered by blotting paper. Defendant being told that the documents were of a private nature, and as to why they would sign, only the lawyer could tell you. It was held that the defense of non est factum applied, even though the defendant could not say precisely what type of document he thought he was signing. Then we have Saunders and Anglia Building Society, which is another case illustrating the point. Original plaintiff, Mrs. Galley, who died before 1970, wanted to help her nephew Parkin to raise money on the security of her leasehold house, provided she could continue to live there rent-free for the rest of her life. Parkin did not want to raise the loan or become owner of the house himself, as he feared this would enable his wife, from whom he was separated, to enforce a claim for maintenance against him. He therefore arranged that his friend Lee should raise the money on a mortgage of Galley's house and then give money to him. Before Lee could mortgage the house, it had to be transferred to him. An assignment was prepared under which the lease of the house was transferred to Lee for £3,000. A reasonable price was included in the assignment so as not to subsequently arouse the building society's suspicion. When Galley was asked to sign the assignment, she did not read it because her glasses were broken. But Lee told her it was a deed of gift to Parkins, who witnessed the document. Lee then raised the money by mortgaging the property to the Anglia Building Society. But he did not pay any money to Parkins, nor did he pay the £3,000 to Galley. It was held that non est factum did not apply to Galley's signature of the assignment since her mistake was not sufficiently serious. She believed the document would enable Parkin to raise money on the security of the house, and the document was designed to achieve this aim, though by a different method than that contemplated by Galley. It was also stated that Mrs. Galley's carelessness prevented her from relying on non est factum. So remember that we had said that if you're careless, you can't rely on the doctrine of non est factum to avoid contractual obligation. So that is a mistake in its entirety, and I would encourage you to take a close look at the slides that we have mounted. So the next thing that we are going to be looking at in terms of vitiating factors is misrepresentation. So bear in mind again that mistake renders a contract void, which means it is invalid from the outset. As we continue with contract law, we are going to be looking at vitiating factors. So we have established the elements of contract formation. We've said for there to be a binding contract, we must have valid offer, valid acceptance, good consideration, intention to create a binding relationship, and the capacity to contract. And having established that there is a valid contract, we now look at what are the contents of the contract. And know that we distinguish between a statement that is mere representation as opposed to a statement that is a term of the contract. And the Oscar Chess case establishes four tests that must be applied to determine whether a statement is a mere representation or it is a term of the contract. And then we have established that there are two broad terms. There are express terms and there are implied terms. Where express terms are concerned, there are two categories or three categories, namely the condition, warranty, intermediate term. And then where implied terms are concerned, terms can be implied by custom, they can be implied through the courts, and if they're implied through the courts, then they're implied by the facts or they're implied in law. And then, of course, terms can be implied by statute. So I mean, establish what the content of the contract is, then we now go on to look at vitiating factors. So we have a valid contract, and the question is, what can negate that contract or what can negative that contract? And these are called vitiating factors. And vitiating factors include mistake, misrepresentation, duress, undue influence, and illegality. And we're going to look at the effect that these factors have on a contract. So let's begin. So where the elements required to form a contract are all present, the parties are entitled to assume that the expectations reasonably raised by their conduct will be sanctioned by the court. So there are circumstances in which this assumption may be defeated by the presence of other factors such as by mistake, which at common law may make the contract void, or by misrepresentation, which may make the contract voidable. It is generally in the interest of business that contracts be enforced. Thus, most mistakes, for example, as to the quality of a product will not affect the validity of a contract. So what we need to now recognize that there are common law rules on mistake, and if applicable, the effect is to render the contract void, but these rules are exercised within narrow limits. And then there are equitable rules of mistake, which have a wider scope, but they have a less dramatic effect. It is important to distinguish a contract which is void for mistake from one which is voidable for misrepresentation. The distinction is of little importance to the parties themselves, since the goods or monies can be recovered from the other party to the contract if they are still in his or her possession. The distinction is of significance if the goods have been sold to a third party. For example, if A sells his car to B and B resells it to C, if the contract between A and B is void for mistake, A can recover the car from C because no title passes under a void contract. C will be able to sue B for breach of the implied condition that he had a right to sell and pass the title. However, in a similar situation, if the contract between A and B is only voidable for misrepresentation, then provided the sale to C took place before A avoided the contract, C will obtain a good title since voidable means valid until avoided. A would then have to seek remedy for misrepresentation against B. So let's pause here to just establish that for mistake at common law, contract is void, meaning it did not exist. It's void ab initio, void from the outset. And misrepresentation, it is voidable, which means that the contract is valid until it is avoided. And in those circumstances, it has implication in relation to whom the person may sue to recover the items or for breach of contract. So we're going to look at the common law rules now of mistake. So the following types of mistake render a contract void, provided the mistake actually induces the contract. So what are the types of mistake? One, mistake as to the existence of the subject matter. Two, mistake as to the possibility of performing contract. Three, mistake as to the identity of the subject matter. Four, mistake as to the identity of the other party. And five, mistake as to the terms of the contract of which the other party is aware. So we take them in turn. One, mistake to the existence of the subject matter. And here we're going to be relying on the case law to illustrate the point. So the first case that we're going to look at is Galloway and Galloway. A man and a woman made a separation agreement believing that they were married. In fact, they were not married because unknown to them at the time of their marriage ceremony, the man's wife still alive. Separation agreement was held to be void for mistake because the marriage, which was the basis of the agreement, was void. Second type of mistake is mistake as to the possibility of performing the contract. And here again, we look to the common law, and the case here is Sheik Brothers and Oxner. A contract was made for the exploitation of sisal grown on a specific plot of land. The contract provided for an average daily delivery of 50 tons of sisal per month. Contract was held to be void because the land was not capable of producing 50 tons per month. The third type of mistake that we're going to look at is mistake as to the identity of the subject matter. And an example is A intends to buy product X, but B intends to buy product Y. And when we go back to first principles, this is an example of cross offer, cross purposes. So the minds are not meeting. And remember that we said if there's an offer, the acceptance must reflect, mirror that offer. Therefore, if there is any difference in terms of the acceptance or the terms of acceptance and the offer, that might be a counter offer. And if there's a mismatch, then it is a cross offer. So no contract will be found. So if there is a mistake as to the identity of the subject matter, then it is likely that that contract is going to be void for mistake. And here, the case is Raffles and Wichelhaus. So the plaintiff agreed to sell to the defendant a consignment of cotton, which was to arrive ex-Peerless Bombay, and that was the name of a ship. There happened to be two ships called Peerless sailing from Bombay, one in October and the other in December. The plaintiff was thinking of the one ship and the defendant of another, and it was held that there was no contract because the parties, the minds, had not met in relation to the same ship. So there was a mistake. So mistake as to the identity of the subject matter. It is important to be able to distinguish a mistake as to the identity of, as to identity, as opposed to a mistake as to quality. Now remember, so we have a general rule, and what we're saying is, generally speaking, mistake is renders a contract void, whereas mistake as to quality does not render a contract void. So all the five types of mistake would have the effect of rendering the contract void, except for mistake as to quality, which does not render the contract void. And persons may sometime not be able to distinguish between mistake as to identity and mistake as to quality, but one has to pay close attention. So in Smith and Hughes, and this gives us an example now of mistake as to quality as opposed to mistake to identity. So the plaintiff was shown a sample of oats by the defendant, and thinking that they were old oats, he bought them. They were in fact new oats, and he refused to accept them. It was held that his mistake did not invalidate the contract because this was a mistake as to quality. Parties were at cross purposes, but not to such an extent that there was no agreement at all. The mistake was only one of quality, and as such does not operate to render the contract void. A mistake as to quality will only invalidate the contract if it is a mistake as the fundamental quality by which the thing is identified, but not if it is a mistake as to one of the various other qualities of the product. And I trust that is clear. So if the quality is intertwined with the identity, so like for instance, Blue Mountain Coffee, as opposed to Colombian Coffee, then that is a question of quality and identity that is intertwined. But if it is a version of Blue Mountain Coffee, then it would not be a mistake as to identity necessarily. Now, the fourth type of mistake is mistake as to the identity of the other party. The mistake as to the identity cannot be made when the parties deal face to face. In such a situation, a person can only make a mistake as to the attributes, i.e. the quality of the other party and not his identity. An agreement made between X and Y will be void if X can prove that at the time of the agreement, he regarded the identity of the other party as of importance. He did not intend to contract with Y, but with a different person, Z. And the fact was known to Y. So if Y knows that Z is not intent on contracting with them, then that is a mistake as to identity and the contract would be void. So to illustrate the point is Conley and Lindsay case. So here a fraudulent person named Blencarn, writing from 37 Wood Street, Cheapside, offered to buy handkerchiefs for the plaintiff who manufactured handkerchiefs. And he signed his letter in such a way that his name appeared to be Blencarn and Company, or Blencarn and Co. The latter was a respectable firm carrying on business at 123 Wood Street. Blencarn occupied a room which he called 37 Wood Street, but in fact, its entrance was from an adjoining street. Plaintiffs, who were aware of the high reputation of Blencarn and Co., though they neither knew nor troubled to ascertain the number of the street where they did business, purported to accept the offer and dispatch the goods to Messrs. Blencarn and Co., 37 Wood Street, Cheapside. These were received by the rogue Blencarn, and he in turn sold them to the defendants, who took them in all good faith. Plaintiff sued the defendants for conversion. It was held that there was no contract between the plaintiffs and Blencarn, since the plaintiffs intended to deal with someone else. Thus the title to the handkerchiefs did not pass to Blencarn, and so he could not pass title to the defendants. The defendants therefore had to return the handkerchiefs to the plaintiffs. And this case can be contrasted with Lewis and Avery, where a rogue posing as Richard Green, well-known film actor, called upon the plaintiff and offered to buy his car, which was advertised for sale at £450. The plaintiff accepted the offer and was given a check signed R.A. Green for £450. Afraid that the check might be worthless, he resisted the proposal that the car should be removed at once. The rogue, by way of showing that he was Richard Green, produced a special pass of admission to Pinewood Studios bearing an official stamp. Satisfied with this, the plaintiff handed over the logbook and allowed the car to be taken away. The check had been stolen and was worthless. The rogue, now passing as Lewis, sold the car to the defendant and handed over the logbook to him. The action of conversion by the plaintiff for the recovery of the car or its value failed. The Court of Appeal held that despite his mistake, the plaintiff had concluded a contract with the rogue. He had failed to rebut the prima facie presumption that he had made a contract with a rogue when he allowed the car to be taken away. The contract was no doubt voidable for fraud, but it could not be avoided now that the car had come into the hands of an innocent purchaser for value. Voidable means valid until avoided, and the plaintiff had not avoided by the time the rogue sold the car to the defendant. The contract was therefore valid, and the rogue was able to pass title to the defendant. And I pause here to say that there is a thin line here between mistake as to the identity of the other party and that of fraudulent misrepresentation. And in these particular instances, what is happening is that the court is actually making a decision on the basis of fraudulent misrepresentation as opposed to mistake as to the identity of the other party. So in King Norton Metal and Eldridge Merritt, the plaintiff received an order for wire from Hallam & Co. The letterhead depicted a large factory and described Hallam & Co. as a substantial firm. In fact, Hallam & Co. did not exist, being merely an alias for a crook called Wallace. Plaintiff sent the goods to Hallam & Co. on credit. Wallace took possession of them and resold them to the defendant. It was held that as Wallace and Hallam and Co. were the same person, the plaintiff had not made a mistake as to identity, but had intended to contract with the writer of the letters. Thus, the contract was only voidable for fraud, and since Wallace sold to the defendants before the plaintiff avoided the contract, the defendant obtained good title to the goods. So that takes us now to the fifth type of mistake at common law, which is a mistake as to the terms of the contract of which the other party is aware. And here, the case illustrating this point is Hartog and Collins and Shields. The seller of hair skin mistakenly offered them at a price per pound instead of per piece, there being about 3 pieces to the pound. The buyer, knowing of the mistake, accepted the offer and later sued the seller for non-delivery. His actions failed since he knew that the seller did not intend to contract on the terms stated. So that now brings us to how do we categorize mistake. And there are different terminologies that are used to describe the various types of mistake. So we have unilateral mistake. This occurs when one of the parties is mistaken about some fundamental fact and the other party knows or should know this. And an example is in the case of Cundy and Lindsay. And then there's bilateral or common mistake. And this occurs when both parties make the same mistake. Usually, this will be a mistake as to the existence of the subject matter. Example, Galloway and Galloway. And then the third category is mutual mistake. This occurs when two parties mean different things. It will normally be a mistake as to identity of the subject matter of the contract. And an example there is Raffles and Wichell House. So we have looked at mistake as a vitiating factor in the context of common law. We said that there are 5 types of mistake. We have identified them, we have explained them, and we have used cases to illustrate them. So we go now to the rules relating to mistake having regard to equity. So the rules of equity where mistake is concerned. So equity will, in limited situations, relieve a party from the effects of his mistake where the common law would hold him to the contract. So in fulfillment of the principles of equity, the court interferes in 2 respects. First, it will, if it thinks fit, set aside the contract on such terms as are just, whether it is void at common law or not. And the equitable remedy is that of rescission. Secondly, it rectifies a written contract or deed that does not accurately record the agreement made by parties. And the equitable remedy here is rectification. So we have two equitable remedies in relation to mistake when the rules of equity are applied. One, rescission. Two, rectification. So let's look a little bit closer at these equitable remedies. So rescission, the circumstances when this remedy will be granted have never been precisely defined. In general, it will only be granted if the party seeking to rescind was not at fault, so that's the innocent part, and provided justice can be done to the other party by imposing conditions. So the case that establishes or illustrates this point is Grist and Bailey. Plaintiff agreed to buy the defendant's house subject to an existing tenancy. The value of the house with vacant possession was about £2,250, but the plaintiff, the purchase price was fixed at £850 since both parties believed that the tenancy was protected by the Rents Act. This belief was wrong. In fact, the tenant left without claiming protection. In an action for a specific performance, and this again is another equitable remedy, brought by the plaintiff, the defendant counterclaimed that the contract be set aside on the ground of common mistake. So whereas the person who is bringing the suit is relying on equitable remedies, the person who is defending the suit is relying on common law. Remember that at common law, the mistake would render the contract void, and therefore it would have no effect from the outset. Whereas in equity, contract is not going to be invalidated, but the parties will be allowed to go back to the drawing board and renegotiate the terms of the contract if it is fair for them. So in Grist and Bailey, it was held that though the mistake did not suffice to nullify the contract at law, it was material enough to attract the intervention of equity. And that is really the statement of equity. So equity is not going to render the contract invalid. Equity is going to seek to find a remedy that is fair in the circumstances. So the contract for a sale of £850 was rescinded in equity with the condition imposed that the vendor should give the purchaser first option to buy the house at the correct market price. So we turn now to look at the other equitable remedy of rescission. And remember, we're now looking at the context of mistake in the context of equitable remedies or equity, equitable rules. So where there has been a mistake, not in the actual agreement, but in the reduction, in its reduction to writing, equity will rectify the written document so that it coincides with the true agreement of the parties. Suppose that A orally agrees to sell a house exclusive of its adjoining yard to B. Owing to a mistake, the latter formally and through written instrument includes the yard as part of the property to be sold. And what is worse, subsequent conveyance actually conveys the yard to B. In a case of this type, where it is proved that owing to a mistake, the written contract does not substantially represent the real intention of the parties, the court has jurisdiction not only to rectify the written agreement, but also to order specific performance of its rectification, right? Or specific performance of it as rectified. So what are we talking about here? So now we're talking about two remedies. talking about rectification, and we're talking about specific performance, and these are equitable remedies. So a mistake is made, land is sold that was not intended to be sold, and this is put in writing. It's brought to the court's attention, the court accepts that there's a mistake made, the court says, well, based on equity, you have to rewrite this contract to reflect what the parties had actually agreed. And since you would have transferred the land to the buyer by mistake, the buyer now has to transfer that land back to the original owner because they know fully well that the original owner had no intention of selling that part of land. So it is, however, not the contract itself which is rectified, but the incorrect manner in which the common intention of the parties have been expressed in a later document. So you're not changing the original contract. What you're doing is correcting the wrong or the false documentation. So rectification will be allowed provided, one, the terms were clearly agreed between the parties. Two, the agreement continued unchanged up to the time it was written. Three, the writing fails to express the agreement of the parties. So here's a case that illustrates the point. So Weeds and Blaney, plaintiff orally agreed with the defendant to sell him a farmhouse and some land. Plaintiff solicitor, in error, prepared a contract which included further land owned by the plaintiff. The error was not noticed and the land was transferred to the defendant, who became the registered owner. It was held that the plaintiff was entitled to rectify or to rectification of the contract and the transfer. So again, the court is correcting the error that was made. That brings us now to the Latin remedy of nonis factum. So we have dealt with mistake as a vitiating factor. We have looked at the five types of mistake at common law. We have looked at the three categories in which mistake can be placed. And we have looked at the equitable rules of mistake and the equitable remedies that are applicable when we're talking about mistake in equity, which is rescission, rectification, specific performance. So this remedy that we are speaking about has to do with whether documents are mistakenly signed. So this mistake is different from the mistake that we are speaking about when it comes on to common law mistake and equitable rules of mistake. This mistake is if the party has not genuinely addressed their minds to the contract that they are entering into. But we must remember we start from a general rule. And what is the general rule? General rule is that signed documents, the general rule concerning signed documents is that a person is bound even if he or she does not read or understand the document. So let us be clear. So as a starting point, what we're saying is that once you sign a document, if you don't read it, if you don't understand it, you are bound by it. So you cannot say it's a mistake if you didn't read it. Nor can you say it is a mistake if you did not understand it. So let's be clear. And this is not the first time that we would have come upon this general rule. We met this general rule when we're looking at exclusion clauses under the content of contract. And what we were discussing there is how do exemption clauses or exclusion clauses are incorporated into a contract. And one of them is if you sign a document without reading, then you are binding yourself to the term of that contract, right? And Lestrange and Gorkum is the case that illustrates that point. Now, here is the exception to that general rule. And the exception to that general rule is captured by the Latin phrase, nonis factum. It is not my act. So, however, an apparent signed contract will be regarded as void if a party can successfully plead the defense non est factum. And to successfully plead the defense of non est factum, three conditions must be satisfied. One, signature must have been induced by fraud. So here we go again, talking about fraud. So this is not a case where you were careless and you didn't read the document or you didn't understand what you signed anyway. Two, document must be fundamentally different from that thought to be signed. That is a subset of the fraudulent activities. So somebody say you're signing a car loan and it turns out that is a house loan you're signing, right? Two different. And then a mistake as the contents is not sufficient to allow non est factum to be raised. So again, it is not the content of the contract itself, but that what you are signing to is not what you had agreed any at all. So the party who is seeking to avoid the liability must prove that they acted with reasonable care. So the defendant, and here's a case that illustrates the point, this defense of non est factum, Lewis and Clay. So the defendant was induced to sign two promissory notes by the fraudulent misrepresentation that his signature was required as a witness. The rest of the document, apart from the space for the signature, was covered by blotting paper. Defendant being told that the documents were of a private nature, and as to why they would sign, only the lawyer could tell you. It was held that the defense of non est factum applied, even though the defendant could not say precisely what type of document he thought he was signing. Then we have Saunders and Anglia Building Society, which is another case illustrating the point. Original plaintiff, Mrs. Galley, who died before 1970, wanted to help her nephew parking to raise money on the security of her leasehold house, provided she could continue to live there rent-free for the rest of her life. Parkin did not want to raise the loan or become owner of the house himself, as he feared this would enable his wife, from whom he was separated, to enforce a claim for maintenance against him. He therefore arranged that his friend Lee should raise the money on a mortgage of Galley's house and then give money to him. Before Lee could mortgage the house, it had to be transferred to him. An assignment was prepared under which the lease of the house was transferred to Lee for £3,000. A reasonable price was included in the assignment so as not to subsequently arouse the building society's suspicion. When Galley was asked to sign the assignment, she did not read it because her glasses were broken. But Lee told her it was a deed of gift to Parkins, who witnessed the document. Lee then raised the money by mortgaging the property to the Anglia Building Society. But he did not pay any money to Parkins, nor did he pay the £3,000 to Galley. It was held that non est factum did not apply to Galley's signature of the assignment since her mistake was not sufficiently serious. She believed the document would enable Parkin to raise money on the security of the house, and the document was designed to achieve this aim, though by a different method than that contemplated by Galley. It was also stated that Mrs. Galley's carelessness prevented her from relying on non est factum. So remember that we had said that if you're careless, you can't rely on the doctrine of non est factum to avoid contractual obligation. So that is a mistake in its entirety, and I would encourage you to take a close look at the slides that we have mounted. So the next thing that we are going to be looking at in terms of vitiating factors is misrepresentation. So bear in mind again that mistake renders a contract void, which means it is invalid from the outset.